Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Well, I'll be damned. It's the first part of our dive into Goethe's Faust. Technically, this is part one of Faust part one. We cover everything from the three introductions to the beginning of the Gretchen plot. So basically, this is the episode where we get bogged down in Goethe's ontological / epistemological outlook, theological reconfiguration, and existential meditations. The pervy stuff comes next episode when we tackle the Gretchen plot. If you're online, check us out at thecannonballpodcast.wordpress.com. Find us on Facebook at The Cannonball Podcast and on Twitter at Cannonball Pod. In all those instances, that's Cannon, C-A-N-O-N. The Cannonball is a proud member of the Agora Podcast Network. Check out some of our sister shows over at the network at agorapodcastnetwork.com. One last note. If you're in the New York area and need reading and writing tutoring or are interested in online tutoring, let us know. Claude has a tutoring business on the side and a newborn, so he is always looking for a few more clients. If you need some help, send an email to claudemoinc@gmail.com. That's claudemoinc@gmail.com. We can also produce literary lectures on demand. I'm not entirely certain what situations would call for that, but they are bound to arise. And when they do, hit us up for some quality literary infotainment.
Happy holidays, happy new year, whenever this happens to come out, and what the fuck? Welcome to the Cannonball, this is Claude Meyer and Goozer, and what the fuck?
Man, the next hour of radio, dear listener, is going to be us answering that question, because we did the background, right? I mean, we had that great background up about Goethe. The writer of today's selection. Folks, we're talking about Faust. We're
talking about one.
Faust part one, which isn't even the crazy part.
Yeah, this thing is so bizarre. This is really one of those works where, it's problematic to some degree. We'll talk about the rampant misogyny. It's not problematic to some degree. It's problematic to a high degree.
Right. I mean, yeah. But we'll address that head on. Like, it's right. Not something we're going to be making apologies for working around. I think it's essential to the text, really.
Yeah, it's not subtext, it's text. but this is such a weird work. Okay, it's weird for a lot of different reasons. One is something that we were talking to, or that I was talking about with Rachel during the background episode. It's the hodgepodge nature of it. Like, it's really fragmented. Yeah. Goethe wrote it over many, many, many years. He kept coming back to revise it, to rework it, to add pieces to it, to try to make it something. The original inception of it came when he was in his, I believe, early 20s, when he was going through the Sturm und Drang period. He went back and heavily revised it while he was embedded in, or while he was sort of promoting and developing the Weimar classicism. So it has wild variety in terms of what the pieces mean, what they're about, how he was thinking them and rethinking them. So it really is this weird hodgepodge grab bag work. It's also just completely fragmentary. Like the pieces kind of go together, and depending on the translation that you get, the translator may try to make it work more together or may try to make it work less together. But really the truth is, this is like he would write scenes to just bridge things that are only there to bridge things. And it's just bizarre. And this is such a strange hodgepodge work that it really is striking and weird that this is canonical, but it kind of works.
Yeah, from what you're describing, I'm a little bit, if you'll permit me to be a little bit record store guy about this. Are you familiar with the Beach Boys album Smile?
Yes. Okay, that's a great that's a great comparison.
Right. So for folks listening at home who may not know about this one, so after the Beach Boys had their huge hit with Pet Sounds, they went back into the studio, and I'm fast and simplifying, of course, the epic of Brian Wilson's creative biography is not something we can go into. But they followed up their, like, you know, sort of, you know, they were world bestriding rock and roll titans at this point. And their follow up to their biggest record was this incredibly fragmentary, disjointed, almost crazy quilt of pop. But it would be, you know, phrases rather than complete songs. There were a couple of complete songs on it. But most of the record was more like you'd have a 40 seconds of what might be a chorus in one song, followed by a bridge for something else. And they're, you know, the record store executives were just, you know, they didn't know what to do with it. They were, I believe, I forget the name of the fellow who exclaimed, but he just exclaimed, "It's pieces. It's just pieces." And yeah, that's what Faust is, really.
Yeah, it's, and okay, Brian Wilson was slowly losing his mind while he was trying to put together Smile. I don't think Goethe was losing his mind. It was just, he was also under a couple of different things, or a couple of different pressures. Like at one point, his publisher wanted more to it to put out in like a selected edition. So he had to revise and rework this one section, but then that didn't fit how he was thinking about art at that point. So he had to rework this and that. I mean, it's all over the place. And so trying to find like a unified, coherent message or coherent theme is really, I mean, it's difficult. There are critics who do it, who try to do it, but I think, all right, I don't know the German, and I don't know the critical history, so this is just really a far outside educated guess, educated by having read three different editions with all kinds of annotations and a couple of like other critical texts to go along with it. Also having talked to this friend of mine, I think the attempts to try to make this a quote unquote coherent work kind of miss the point. Like, when I was talking to Rachel, this came up that I wanted to compare it to T.S. Eliot in some way, shape, or form, not necessarily in terms of the same outlook. I think Goethe would be annoyed with Eliot. But in terms of the fragmentary nature of the work, and one of the things that occurred after The Wasteland, a whole, I guess, field of criticism arose basically to account for modern writing and modernist writing. And so part of what they were trying to do in the 30s and 40s with New Criticism was sort of make this claim for a coherence within certain kinds of texts that proclaimed their fragmentariness, right? So if you look at The Wasteland, it's all in bits and pieces, and that's Eliot's reflection of the fragmentation of 20th century life. Pound's cantos are all in bits and pieces, and that's his own weird fascist thing. I'm not even being ironic. That's Pound's fascism. The more a lot of these critics insisted on the inherent unity of something like The Wasteland, the more you get the feeling that they're missing the point. Like they're really stretching to try to make it a more stable text than it is. Not stable in the terms of like a historically stable or unstable text, but in terms of what I mean by that has to do with editing. Like King Lear is not exactly a stable text because there are several different versions of it. But anyway, what's the variant? What's not the variant? So on and so forth. No, this is just all over the place in terms of being fragmented. And the more you try to make it make sense, I think you're sort of missing something. So you have to take it for what it is.
Right. And I would say that that is kind of in keeping with Goethe's pushing back against the Enlightenment, which is made very explicit in my favorite character, who shows up during the Walpurgisnacht, which I guess we'll get to at one point. But I do think that that's, to the extent that we can impute any kind of intention to this, I would say that like that's kind of part of Goethe's rebellion against the Enlightenment, you know, because what is the perfect Enlightenment rationality would be some, you know, perfect clockwork. It'd be like a Pope epic, right? Alexander Pope, where everything is in these perfect clockwork couplets and it all ties together. And, you know, I and again, not knowing the German, I don't know quite how tightly Faust is metered. I imagine it's a poetic play, so you know it does have meter. But if you come in looking for like a straight line to follow, you're not going to find it. The closest that you have to a straight line is the relationship between Faust and Mephistopheles, and how they are. You know, how they interact, how they are, how they annoy each other throughout their time together. Claude, how do you want to even approach this? I guess, how do we express this to the audience?
I think we just have to dive right in. Usually what we do is start with a kind of synopsis and then move back into an analysis. But I think we have to do the two at the same time because on the one hand, this isn't, what we've been advertising is this fragmentary work, but on the other hand, it's dense in terms of what Goethe is doing with it at a couple of certain points. There are some real complicated things he's laying out on the table, and he's really thinking through things in these really in-depth ways. things that I think are burgeoning in Faust, I mean, maybe not for German Romanticism, but for this is frustrating because my familiarity is with English and American Romanticism, and American Romanticism is this kind of offshoot of English Romanticism. My familiarity is with English Romanticism, but that comes a little bit later than Faust. And you can see some ideas in Faust, or that comes a little bit later than Goethe's early writing, which is where Faust sort of began, the Sturm und Drang, let's call it. You can see these ideas in there that later get taken and developed in a couple of different ways. And there are these points of contact with English Romanticism that I keep seeing that I think are interesting and important to draw out. Let's just dive in. Okay, so the first weirdness of the text is the three introductory pieces. We have a dedication, a prelude on the stage, and then the prologue in heaven. So it's sort of like excuse me. It starts from this authorial remove. Goethe, 20 years after he began, and I believe it was roughly 20 years after he started it, he put it together as a thing. It starts with this authorial distance where he's writing meditatively and somewhat melancholically about the 20 years that have passed, the friends that he's had who are maybe no longer here, who had read this, excuse me, in an earlier form and then never saw the completion, and how these phantoms, these ghosts have kind of been haunting him this whole time. Not just the ghosts of his friends, but the ghosts of the characters, Faustus, Gretchen, Mephistopheles. These are characters that have been with him all this time, and they're so old, right? Mm-hmm. So it's this kind of meditation on time passing and aging and the meaning of this play. And then you have the prelude on the stage. So we start right with the author setting the scene, then go one step down to imagining this kind of meta-theatrical moment where the stage manager, the poet, and the playwright – or sorry, the stage manager, the poet, and the player of comic roles are all acting out their own weird parts. And I believe the tradition is that Mephistopheles – is sort of represented as the player of comic roles. Mephistopheles keeps taking this, I guess he keeps taking this role as the jester.
Right.
And like literally as a jester, that's how we first see him in the prologue in Heaven. And there are moments in Faust Part 2 where a jester walks on stage and there's no stage direction that it's Mephistopheles, but you're just supposed to know. So yeah. Anytime this weird sort of comedic character shows up, it's Mephistopheles. Anyway, the prelude on the stage is this kind of argument between the manager, the poet, and the player about what sells and what would be good to put on. And so it's
I was really fascinated by that. That like Goethe's opening up his play with this pretty mercenary meditation on like how do we get butts in seats, you know?
Well, yeah, and I mean that was the weird thing. That was a concern of his. He was an active you know, manager, director, poet in the theater. He was engaged in the nitty-gritty details of publication. He was interested, I mean, okay, The Sorrows of Young Werther sold out, so he was already a blockbuster. But, you know, the question is, how do you always or how do you keep up with that and so on and so forth, right? So he's not removed from those details, but he does lay it out where, you know, there is this constant tug of war between these three pieces that need something there, but this pressure to make it something more than just, you know, the most recent Marvel movie or the most recent Star Wars movie. Like, there's more to this than that, right?
Yeah.
So how do you balance all three urges? And then finally, we get to the prologue in Heaven. So it's, you know, from the very beginning. All right. So part of this represents that timing of the construction. Right. It started so long ago, and then he had this other idea about it, and then he had another idea about it. But I think it's also got this effect of starting up high with this distanced author, then down to the dress rehearsal, then straight into the performance. But it does remind us that this whole thing in some way, shape, or form is a performance that we're
engaged with. Yeah, it's highlighting the artifice. Well, it's almost Bertolt Brecht, right?
Yeah,
that kind of the Brechtian remove, you know, where you take points in the play to remind everyone that they're watching a play.
Right. Okay. So the biggest shift that occurs in the prologue in Heaven, and the one that I think would probably be not exactly shocking, but surprising to anyone who's heard of this and is reading this for the first time, is that Faust, okay, he doesn't sell his soul. And there's nothing in the text about him selling his soul or bargaining his soul in this way. And ultimately, the opening of the prologue in heaven transforms the material so that it's more of a Jobian wager, right?
Right. And that's what struck me instantly was the fact that in the prologue, you have Mephistopheles, you know, the devil himself, is hanging out, you know, in the firmament with the archangels and the Lord and makes a wager with the Lord. And that's specifically the setup in the Book of Job. Like, I mean, it's one for one.
Yeah. All right. Now, there are a couple of interesting things to dig into when Mephistopheles appears. One, he's apparently dressed as the jester. So if we're imagining the court in heaven, then his role is as the comedian. But he has these – all right. He has this moment when he comes on where he's basically just bagging on everything. He starts talking to God. I've no remarks to make about the sun or planets. I merely see how mankind toils and moils. Earth's little gods still do not change a bit, are just as odd as on their primal day. Their lives would be a little easier if you'd not let them glimpse the light of heaven. They call it reason and employ it only to be more bestial than any beast. Okay. This goes back, or this reminded me of something that we were talking about when we were talking about Milton. The thing that Mephistopheles sees is the way that consciousness is pain, right? Him, awareness and self-awareness is something that brings with it the necessary self-awareness that you are separated from the world around you. So, I mean, this is Nietzschean. There's this drive to get yourself out of your skull, to use your reason to find the whatever thing it is to drive you out of your reason so that you can return to the most bestial state, right? It's the Hunter Thompson thing. Hunter Thompson at the beginning of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas has some quote from Samuel Johnson about bestial people or something like that. And it seems to be what he's – if there's an animus to Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas that's not drugs, it's that part of what you will do in a crazy situation to relieve yourself of the responsibility of a consciousness is drive yourself out of your mind. That's what Mephistopheles seems to be arguing.
Right.
And he's a nihilist in a couple of different ways. God says, "Do you have nothing else to tell me? Do you ever come except to criticize? Is nothing ever right for you on earth?" And he says, "No, Lord, I find things there as always downright bad. I'm so sorry for mankind's unending miseries that even I am loath to plague the wretches." So that's kind of like he's a nihilist. He's a provoker. And
the spirit that always negates, the spirit of negativity. Like, he'll never do anything affirming. He will only upend things. And, you know, if you ever get amusement out of that, that's something you're bringing to it, right? Like, it's never – he's never building anything up.
So they have this kind of back and forth, and the Lord offers up Faust essentially and says – gives Mephistopheles the same dictum that he gives to Satan in Job, where he says, as long as he's alive, you can do whatever you want to him. So Mephistopheles says, sure. God says, though now he only serves me blindly and ineptly, I soon shall lead him into clarity. The gardener knows when the sapling turns green that blossoms and fruit will brighten future years. Okay. God seems to have – all right, this – one more time. This was something that Rachel and I were talking about. Goethe was not exactly a believer, and he really abandoned doctrinaire Christianity, I think, you know, in his teens or 20s. But he, there are things about this work that are extraordinarily Protestant, particularly the ending. the thing that Goethe seems to be getting at with Faust serving God, even if it's slantwise, is this way that error seems to be a part of the human endeavor. And as long as you're striving for the right end, you can keep erring and eventually get there.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a bit of a it's like a counter Calvinism, almost.
Yeah.
Like it. Well, maybe not, I guess, you know, it retains the Calvinist notion of the what he called pervasive depravity, just meaning that there's nothing a human being can do that isn't tainted somehow by their imperfection and inability to live up to God's standards. But whereas, you know, of course, Calvin takes the tact that, like, so that means that you are completely helpless and it's on God whether, you know, you're saved or not. Goethe takes the almost, I guess, almost Pelagian standpoint that, Pelagianism versus Augustinianism, that you can save yourself, but it takes effort. It takes will, and it will never. Well, it's almost like it's like Zeno's arrow, right?
Yeah.
The paradox that, you shoot the arrow and as long as, you know, someone can still be running, you know, half a length ahead of it, whatever, it will never hit them. But that in that striving is what is that striving is what is salvation. Even if you never achieve it, you've achieved it already.
Yeah. That seems to be where Goethe lands, which I guess is ironic if we're talking about Zeno's paradox. But
see, we're already turning ourselves into knots over this stuff, people.
But the thing that he keeps coming back to, or the thing that makes something divine in this work, is the continual striving towards something. If you stop striving, you lapse into the Mephistophelian nihilism.
Right.
You lapse into nothingness. And that is the source of damnation here. So it has less to do with maybe accidentally poisoning your mother and having your brother killed and drowning your baby than it has to do with just accepting the fact that you did that. It's very, very strange. It's very weird. It's counterintuitive. But that seems to be one of those through lines in here where Goethe's trying to work out how Faust can be saved through his damnation in a way.
Right.
All right. So if that's confusing to anyone, I have a PhD and I'm trying to thread the needle on this.
And I'm a dunderhead layman, and I'm having a great time. So
okay,
so let's kick in the gear.
So God, all right. To put this into context, God says, "So be it. Do as you are minded. Divert this spirit from his primal source and drag him, if you can keep hold of him, along your downward path, and stand abashed when you must needs admit a good man in his groping intuition is well aware of what's his proper course." All right, so this I think articulates what we've been getting at. when we get to Wordsworth, which if we ever make it through Faust is actually right around the corner. But if we get to Wordsworth, Wordsworth seems in a couple of his poems to have this idea that we are all innately good. It's social influences which are corrupting. This, I think, is the Rousseauian Wordsworth. But it's social influences which are corrupting, but deep down within us, our drives are to the good. Our drives are towards compassion and care for others and for ourselves and for the world around us. And what we have to do is learn to trust that inner goodness. Don't let anything drag it down, and just trust that the better part of yourself will lead the way. If you just do the right thing, keep doing the right thing that feels like good, right? Not feels good as in just do what you want. That feels good in terms of I'm doing the right thing by others and the right thing by me. Then the hardships that you encounter will lessen. All right. So that idea of a kind of innate goodness is, I think, working in the Lord's words to Mephistopheles here. A good man in his groping intuition is well aware of what's his proper course. It's intuition. We can intuit deep down what exactly it is that we're supposed to do. Right.
Right. Which is itself, again, a kind of that's another sort of riposte to the Enlightenment obsession with rationalizing ethics. Right.
Yeah.
Where it's taking out the claim that you have an innate moral compass and it'll lead you right if you just listen to it. Like, it's not, you don't have to spend 500 pages arguing about the Kantian imperative or what have you.
Yeah. So, he says, excuse me. So Mephistopheles says, agreed, the business won't take long. As for my bet, I'm not the least bit worried. When I achieve my purpose, let me beat my breast triumphantly. Dust shall he eat and greedily, like my celebrated serpent cousin. And the Lord says, when that occurs, again come uninvited. I have no hate for creatures of your kind. Of all the spirits of negation, rogues like you bother me the least. Human activity slackens all too easily, and people soon are prone to rest on any terms. That's why I like to give them the companion who functions as a prod and does a job as a devil. There's literally a necessary evil here. The threat of nihilism, the threat of nothingness, is a prod to energy and activity, a prod to keep going, to keep finding your way. And there are several different versions of nihilistic nothingness. One is a kind of sloth. The other is a kind of cynicism. The cynic who says that your intuition is just X, Y, or Z, or love is just chemistry, man. I'm a cold, dark loser.
But the edgelord in your college philosophy club.
Yeah, there you go.
Not saying I was the kind of nerd to join my college philosophy club. Certainly not. Anyway.
But that's what I think he's getting at here. That's the true danger, is the lapse into nothingness, the stopping striving. And there's something about nihilism that can be a prod to keep going. And there's something about nihilism that can also be a drag to stop. Right.
Yeah.
So that's how Mephistopheles is sort of kind of functioning here. It's really tough to work out because you kind of have to get yourself attuned to this weird framework that you're just playing with. But I think once you get that, once you stop thinking about it in terms of sin and evil and more in terms of drive and the negation of drive, then it starts to become clearer. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because I think the error that a first-time reader might come into with this, this is the error that I made when I first read this, said, okay, this is going to be a dark, gloomy work about sin and selling your soul. It's not. There are parts that are really sort of disturbing, but it's not quite that. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So we move from the prologue in heaven to Night. And this was one of the earliest pieces that he wrote. This is Faust long-windedly droning on about how exhausted and tired and worn out he is from being a professor. Only someone with tenure would have this kind
of complaint. I don't know if maybe this hit home a little bit for you. I couldn't assume that, but.
Well, I've been grading papers all day today, but.
I guess it's a little different. His weariness comes from feeling like he's seen it all. you know, and that it's rather than, you know, just the grind of getting through the, you know, work with your students' material. He's more like philosophy, done it, medicine, done it, you know, theology, been there, you know, and I'm still dumb as a bag of rocks.
Well, there's still a kind of cynicism. There's a creeping cynicism, I think, at work in him. On line 365, he says, "This is too much for heart to bear. I may well know more than all those dullards, those doctors, teachers, officials, and priests, be unbothered by scruples or doubts, and fear neither hell nor its devils, but I get no joy from anything either, know nothing that I think worthwhile, and don't imagine that what I teach could better mankind or make it godly."
Yeah.
So it's not just exhaustion. It's being burnt out and feeling the futility.
Right. Futility. That's closer to it than just like sheer
everything.
Yeah. Exhaustion. It's futility. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and so maybe this does hit home after spending years and years and years studying all this stuff and being able to read it all and being paid nothing and having student after student write the worst essay of my entire career and not really having a career. Yeah, it kind of hits home. So anyway, it really goes on, and this is I think a reasonably compelling piece to read. So the question is, how do you get out of this? The first thing he tries to do is open a book of magic, and he views the sign of the macrocosm. He contemplates the sign, and it's like, oh, there's this beautiful image of the entire universe, and I know everything about it, but then it's not enough for him. He says, "How grand a show, but still, alas, mere show, infinite nature. When can I lay hold of you and of your breasts, you fountains of all life on which the heavens and earth depend, towards which my withered heart is straining? You flow, you nurse, and yet I thirst in vain." All right. So he goes from the sign of the macrocosm to conjuring the earth spirit, and the earth spirit says, "What do you want?" And he's so overwhelmed by this thing that he conjured that he can't even really quite say
stammers and you know, tongue tied, and
he says, you know, I am made in God's image and I'm part of you, and the earth spirit says, no, you have nothing to do with me. And so that's a brutal insult to the soul of Faust, and he shrinks away defeated. All right, so what is the sign of the macrocosm, and what is the earth spirit? All right, I'm going to pull an aside here and just say, if you're reading along, the work that we're mainly focusing on, or the translation that we're mainly focusing on, is Stuart Atkins' translation that was put out through Princeton University Press. That's the main translation, and really in a lot of ways it's the most reader-friendly and it's the most poetic. There's another translation that I've also been using, which was David Luke's, put out by the Oxford University Press, and that one's also fairly fluid and tries to catch more of the verse. And then there's Walter Arndt's, put out through Norton. Okay, so Arndt's is the driest of them all and really kind of the most academic. Yeah. It's not exactly reader-friendly, but between all of these, Arndt's has the best notes. So I've been consulting the notes for Arndt, some of the notes for the Oxford, and mostly relying on the Atkins translation for, I guess, our analysis here. Arndt had some interesting notes on the sign of the macrocosm versus the earth spirit. Okay. So there are a couple of things to note here. First, the sign of the macrocosm, as Faust is discussing it, it seems to be like, okay, the thing that I kept thinking of was in Star Wars, where they pull up the image of the Death Star as this kind of like 3D graphic that's floating in space. That seems to be what, Goethe has in mind. It's an image. It's a hologram in a way. It's this thing that seems to give truth, but it's just the outer appearance. Right. Faust doesn't want the outer appearance. He doesn't want one more thing to contemplate. He wants to be in it and of it. But the issue is, once he's confronted with that, he shrinks from it. Okay. So there's a major shift here, and that's that in the usual iterations of Faust, in the usual or in the source material, and even in Marlowe's play, which Goethe didn't read until after he'd finished Faust, which is surprising because there are a lot of similarities, but in Goethe's or in Marlowe's play and in the source material, what Faust does is gets tired and weary with life, and so then conjures the devil. But here, he doesn't conjure the devil, he conjures an earth spirit. So we're de-Christianizing a lot of stuff that's going on here. We're moving it away from sin towards material experience.
Yeah.
And material experience is something that is alien to him. So he shrinks from that and falls into despair. The spirit has this interesting line about itself. In the tides of life and action storms, I surge and ebb, move to and fro, as cradle and grave, as unending sea, as constant change, as life's incandescence, I work at the whirring loom of time and fashion the living garment of God. So what the earth spirit is kind of like the material covering that allows the sort of energy and drive of the divine to shine through. Yeah. Or allows it to function. But it's this other kind of innate materialism or this active life that Faust has nothing to do with.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So at that point, Faust is interrupted by Igor. I mean, Wagner.
Renfield approaches.
Yes. Okay. So I'm being a little glib here, but this really is the prototype of that figure. You can trace it because Byron did a play that was basically a not very funny ripoff of Faust. Mm-hmm. And Byron could rightly claim that he'd never read Faust because he had no German. But Shelley, who he's hanging out with at the time, had plenty of German and read in translation tons of pieces of Faust too.
Yeah.
So Byron pretty much ripped it off and wrote this thing called Manfred about this guy who is facing this – well, he's this wizard who's facing this existential crisis of damnation because apparently he slept with his sister, which is in no way – exactly like the thing that Byron did, which got him driven out of England. To Byron's credit, it was his half-sister.
I'll give that half credit in that case.
Well, he didn't know at the time, but when he found out...
Yeah.
When they found out, she sent him a letter and said, "Oh my God, can you believe what he did? What we did?" And he sent a letter back saying, "Wow, that's messed up. So what are you doing next Tuesday?"
All right.
All right. So anyway, that got him killed. So in Byron's sort of retelling of Faust called Manfred, which if you are looking for gothy, gloomy creepiness, go check out Manfred because it's over the top and fun and creepy. But you have a figure like this who is made less bumbling and silly and more full on nefarious or just creepy sidekicky. Mm-hmm. And this is really sort of the start of the Igor trope.
Yeah, yeah. The mad scientist's obsequious assistant. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. In Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, that character does not exist.
Yeah, yeah.
That was this kind of gothic invention that gets grafted on in the film versions and is not there. But anyway, that's an aside. We have an interruption by Wagner, almost like my weird digressive interruption there. And Wagner is his famulus. He's basically the TA.
Yeah.
And he's more or less a grad student TA who comes in and says, "Hey, were you declaiming some classical tragedy? My, how smart it makes you." Wagner, he represents, and this is the thing I think about Faust, is that it benefits you not necessarily to think about this as actual characters acting and more like symbolic functions, right?
Yeah.
But Wagner represents this kind of dry, pedantic search for power through knowledge. But I mean, it's ironic because it's what power do you end up with? You end up a dry, dusty old professor like Faust. You know, what's the meme going around? Or there was that meme going around a while back. Everyone says that as an English lit professor, I'm trying to indoctrinate my students into some kind of nefarious communist scheme when I can barely get them to read five pages over the course of 3 months. Anyway, so Wagner mistakes what Faust is doing. Faust is trying to conjure life. He's trying to conjure this engagement with material existence, this sort of fuller, intenser, you know, what have you. And then when it fails utterly, he breaks down and has this impassioned cry. And Wagner thinks, oh, this must be more rhetoric. So Wagner keeps mistaking the actual for the rhetorical, or wisdom for just rote knowledge.
Right.
So Faust makes this case further on down. Wagner is saying, you know, we must study rhetoric in order to know how to say all this stuff. And Faust says, just try to make an honest living and don't put on a cap and bells. Intelligence and proper sense need little art to be expressed. If you have something that you really want to say, is there a need to hunt for words? Let me be blunt. Those sparkling speeches you admire, those paper baubles for mankind's amusement, give no more solace than fog-laden winds that soft through withered autumn leaves. This is that sort of romantic trope of rhetoric versus true expression.
Mm-hmm. And
this is one of those, like, really, I think, formative places where you see it.
Yeah.
Right? This is the animating thing for 90% of romantic lyric poetry. I'm not composing a rhetorical object or a rhetorical argument. I'm composing an actual experience with emotions and whatnot.
Yeah.
Which serves to hide the rhetorical argument underneath the lyric. But anyway, this is one of those expressions of that. And that's why I keep saying that there's so much proto-romantic stuff in here. All right. So you have this pedantic interruption. You have the rhetoric versus reality. And then you have this kind of conversation or discussion about the use of the past. Faust says, is parchment then the sacred fount? And does one drink from it forever slake our thirst? There's nothing you can gain refreshment from except what has its source in your own soul. Okay. So again, this sounds close to Blake, but it's not nearly as pungent. Mm-hmm. You know, in Blake's Marriage of Heaven and Hell, he has all these proverbs of hell about how the energy of the present, you know, rolls over the bones of the past. What is the past for? If it's just inert material, then why are you beholden to it? Right. Why do you view that as the transcendental wisdom of all time when whatever truth you feel inside you is what you should be focusing on? So again, we're back to that intuition, right? So Faust is really tired of Wagner, and he's bemoaning the fact that he's not part of this earth spirit. He's been belittled by it. And he has this meditation on what it means to be human and so on and so forth.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And it ultimately ends, Wagner checks out, and Faust has this, I guess, suicidal moment. He sees a vial of poison. We find out in the next scene that his father was a doctor and he was kind of his father's apprentice, and they went around sort of doctoring to people who had the plague. His father had all these vials of medicine and poison. Maybe they were the same thing, but Faust sees this thing and he's like, okay, this could maybe end it all. And what do I really have to fear? I don't care anymore. There's nothing for me on earth, so I may as well kill myself. And that's when he hears the chorus of angels. There's an Easter chorus going on outside, and he has this redemptive moment where he decides not to kill himself. Hey, and wouldn't you know it, it's Easter. So, he is resurrected. Yeah. His decision not to kill himself doesn't come from a recognition of Christian salvation, though, even though it is triggered by these angels, yeah, or by this chorus of angels or this chorus of Easter song. It's from his own reminiscence.
Yeah.
This hymn announced the lively games of youth, the happy freedom of spring celebrations, the memory of childlike feelings now keeps me from taking the last solemn step. It's not that he finds any kind of orthodox or doctrinaire Christian resurrection or Christian salvation. What he finds is healing this kind of alienation with himself by returning to joyful memories of the past that are triggered by the song.
Which is, I think it's really I noticed that, and it sounds a lot like, you know, how there are, I have a lot of lapsed Christian friends who will mention that when they go home for like holidays or something and attend like a Christmas service with their family or something like that, they come away with a good feeling of, you know, and it's a feeling of community and this absence of alienation because they participated in a joyful occasion with other people. Not necessarily that, again, not like Faust, that they accepted the dogmatic propositions that it is ostensibly predicated upon, but rather just the act of experiencing joy with other people is itself, is itself a joy, even if you're not, you know, Well, it's like this is going to be very insulting, I think, to the Christian service. It's like when you get super hyped when you're watching a football game that you don't care about, but your friends are getting really hyped up about it.
Yeah. And I mean, I got to say, there's a part of me that responds pretty sincerely when I'm holding a candle out in the freezing cold, watching a donkey hang out in front of a fake straw thing with a fake baby.
Absolutely. It brings up, it brings up a lot of feelings in even the most lapsed of American Protestants.
Donkeys may be stubborn, but they're often very sweet. Anyway, so to get back to it, though, that seems to be the thing. When he's taking this is going to be something to keep in mind. This is a symbolic thread that he keeps returning to. When he takes up the poison, it's a mock Eucharist. Mm-hmm. But when he hears the celebration, is reconnected deep down with himself, that's the real salvation. So it's not the drinking of the thing, which will lead to the salvation of nothingness. It's the returning to your memory. And this, again, I think is in opposition to Wagner's obsession with the parchments of the past. This is the actual living memory that can rejuvenate. And what a totally romantic thing that Wordsworth comes back to again.
Yeah.
All right. So it's almost as if Wordsworth had read Faust or Goethe. Anyway, so we have Faust finding this redemptive moment, and then we have outside the city gate. All right. Now, this is this weird scene where – okay, I'm going to keep saying that.
Every scene in Faust is weird, so just everybody just get used to saying that. Yeah.
So this is where that kind of, salvation is enacted in a social way. Everybody, it's springtime, it's Easter, everybody's coming out from being cooped up indoors all winter, and you have this joyous rejuvenation, and Faust, this is going to be complicated because one of the things that we're going to be talking about for the next couple of hours is Goethe's relation to society, man. If there is a movement in Faust, it's one from society as redemptive to society as, poisoning or cynical.
As obstacle to redemption, Yeah.
So but in this moment, society is redemptive and Faust joins the community and rejoins all of these others who are engaged in sort of coming out and celebrating. And there's this kind of, there's this almost painterly, exploration of the peasant life or the common life as a good. Mm-hmm. It's Bruegel. It reminds me of Bruegel.
Yeah.
I don't know if Goethe ever saw Bruegel, but that seems to be the kind of idea. I know he knew Rembrandt, but not like literally knew him, but knew the work. But that seems to be the impulse here to celebrate all of these people who are sort of coming around. And Faust and Wagner are taking their stroll, and they're reintegrated into it. But they're reintegrated in a weird way. On the one hand, they are part of it and enjoying the celebration. On the other, they have this kind of broad romantic vista where they get up on a hill to overlook everything and talk about how everything's going. Again, another romantic trope. In order to understand the whole and experience the sublime of the thing, you have to get up high on the hill to survey the whole. Wordsworth doesn't do this in Tintern Abbey. And if you want to see two extraordinarily ironic 20th century versions of the same are in Wallace Stevens' Man at the Dump, where the high, huge vista is kind of this gigantic mound of trash.
Yeah.
And he sort of de-elevates it. And then Robert Lowell in Skunk Hour is sitting on his back stoop.
Yeah.
Like, that's his vista.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, So anyway, they have this sort of weird, ironic moment. One of the villagers, an old peasant, comes up and offers Faust a beer and says, "Thank you for everything you've done for us," remembering how Faust and his father had cured the plague. And Wagner says, "Wow, it must be great to have all this power over the peasants." Again, the way Wagner is thinking about knowledge and the search for knowledge is, you know, that cynical college student. Wow, I'm going to get a good job.
Right, that kind of social climbing, grasping, apple polishing, resume padding bullshit. You know,
yeah. And Faust says, I mean, this seemed really equivocal to me. He has these lines where he says, all right. He says, "The last appeared a mask of color, that was our medicine. His father was a kind of alchemist. Mm-hmm. The patients died, and no one thought to ask if anyone was healed." Mm-hmm. So they went around and did stuff. But according to Faust's reading of it, they didn't do any good.
Yeah.
And so with diabolical electuaries, we ravaged in these hills and valleys with greater fury than the plague. I have myself dosed thousands with the poison. They wasted away, and I must live to hear the brazen murders adulated.
Yeah.
They were maybe inadvertently poisoning the plague victims, or maybe they were advertently poisoning the plague victims, putting them out of the misery. There's some ambiguity in the text.
Yeah, and
at least in the English. And
what the impression I came away with in this part is that it was kind of, I saw it as evidence of Faust's kind of, I don't know, superiority, his arrogance almost. Because here we have this a peasant whom clearly, you know, in the order of the day, he is obviously socially superior to, even given his ease in interacting with them that Wagner doesn't quite have. Like, Wagner is still, of course, very cognizant of his own. He's very cognizant of trying to increase his superiority. Faust is just comfortable in his superiority and can chill.
Right.
But what really I took away from that is that it's indicative of that same kind of arrogance that instead of coming away from that interaction with any kind of, like, I don't know, warm human feeling, all he can think about is like, those stupid rubes. You know, it's presented on his face. It's almost like Faust being humble in a way, because he's saying like, oh, well, we didn't really help anybody. We didn't know what we were doing, whatever.
Yeah.
But I think more the reading I got from that is it's Faust saying again, like, yeah, those dumb bunch of rubes, like, we were just fleecing them. And, you know, who cares? Or maybe not who cares. Like, he's clearly conflicted about it, but it did feel more like it was kind of establishing Faust as this, you know, arrogant, a very superior feeling guy who knows he's above it all and who derides he doesn't even take any pleasure in the fact that, like, he gave any kind of, like, spiritual or psychic solace to people who were suffering. Like, that doesn't really occur. It was like, well, we didn't actually cure their physical ailment, and so it was all useless. I'm like, no, man, like, your dad did perform a service to these people.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, continue.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And that seems to be coming through. He begins, you know, Wagner says, well, you know, you did your best and everything's cool. And they love you, dude. And Faust has this line, happy the man who still can hope to swim to safety in this sea of error.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Again, error can lead you to so on and so forth. But he has this articulation here of what exactly it is that he's looking for. You know, everything has exhausted him, or he's exhausted with everything and can't find whatever this is that he's striving to know or understand or be. He says, yet in us all, there is an innate urge to rise aloft and soar along when lost in the blue space above us. The lark pours forth its vibrant song when high above fur-covered crags, the eagle floats on outspread wing, and when above the plains and lakes, the crane seeks out its native place. Okay, he's trying to express this kind of transcendent ideal. There's something in us which wants more than just – the material. It's part of what he saw in the Earth Spirit that he couldn't get at. It's something that he's striving towards, but he doesn't even know or understand what it is. I think this is Goethe trying to express that human desire for transcendence.
Yeah.
Right. You know, this goes like, okay, we're mocking Kant a little bit earlier, but that's one of the things that Kant was trying to intervene with. All right. There's this material world. Then there's this, transcendental world beyond space and time, which is what we all strive towards. And Kant is extraordinarily logical about marking out the one and then tries to leave space for the other.
Yeah.
You know? Or to try to articulate as best he can what that other is. And according to Schopenhauer, what Kant really discovers is what Plato said a long time ago. Hey, it's the world of forms. But we're not talking about Schopenhauer now. So anyway, what Faust is trying to articulate is that sort of sense of otherness. Like, what is it in us that wants to be more than just wake up in the morning, have a good breakfast, go off to work, say hi to somebody, do a good job, come home, go to bed.
Right.
Wagner can't understand it beyond the material. Wagner has no idea what he's talking about. Faust says, you only know one driving force, and may you never seek to know the other. Two souls, alas, reside within my breath, and each is eager for a separation in throes of coarse desire. One grips the earth with all its senses. The other struggles from the dust to rise to high ancestral spheres. So one part of him is sort of bound or grounded or desirous of the material of the earth, and the other is desirous of these transcendental experiences. It's almost as if he's articulating what Schiller had proposed in the Letters in the Aesthetic Education on Man, that sex could be a combining of both of these drives. Oh, wait, he did. Goethe was friends with Schiller. And what Faust seems to be articulating here is this thing that becomes a major point throughout the work, sex sex within a certain kind of situation of care for the other can become this transcendental moment, right? Or this transcendental act. The problem is in this earth, it has, or in this world, it has consequences. One being children and disease, another being, I guess it's over and the desire grows for more and faster.
Right.
Right. You can use it to lapse into a kind of cynicism, right? Or it can become this overwhelming drive. But that seems to me, at least through this reading, to be where Faust is trying to link these two things together, or at least Goethe is trying to link these two things together. I don't think he's necessarily overt about it, but symbolically it's kind of the touchstone for the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then they see a poodle.
Okay. They do. And this is another way in which this is, and it's played for laughs. Honestly, right? Because, I mean, it has to be, right?
All right. Well, I think it's played in a couple of different ways. Wagner just sees a dog, and Faust sees flames coming out of the dog.
And we should stress, it is specifically identified as a poodle. That is the breed of dog.
As a black poodle. Okay. I was curious about this, and I asked Rachel, and... You know, is this the translation? Is this just Atkins being weird about this? And she was like, well, you know, poodle could mean in German of the time, any larger dog.
Okay. Right.
Right. But the text makes it pretty clear it's a damn poodle. It's a big, I don't know how this isn't being played for laughs. I mean, it's really kind of this silly thing, but this black poodle starts surrounding them and coming in, and they have this conversation where Faust seems attuned to seeing something more in the poodle than is there. And Wagner can't see anything, but hey man, it's a big black, fuzzy, goofy looking dog. It's Mephistopheles. We know it because we're in on the joke, but Faust doesn't know it yet. He takes the thing home and he tries to translate the Bible. Mm-hmm. You know, like you do when once you had a nice walk. The joke is that the poodle keeps interrupting him every time he's talking about something. He takes it home. He tells it to sit behind the stove and he has this meditation on, you know, I feel so good after having been out. And then the poodle starts growling and jumping around and interrupts his meditation. Then, you know, I feel this drive to connect with the oneness. And then the poodle interrupts him again. And then, he starts translating. He starts translating the New Testament. Specifically, he's translating the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. He translates it in three different ways, and Arndt was pretty insightful on this. He begins with, in the beginning was the Word. No, that's not good. In the beginning was the mind. No, that ain't good.
Right.
Then, in the beginning was the power. No, that's not it. In the beginning was the act. Okay, so... what Arndt traces is the way that Faust in his translation comes to this articulation of the sort of full understanding of the Sturm und Drang to move from rhetoric to the action, right? And this is one of those unfortunate places where if you know your 20th century fascist propaganda, you can't help but see how this emphasis on action above all else really gets taken and perverted.
Right. It's taken as a kind of it's taken as an inversion of the kind of, and you see it a lot in specifically Nazi propaganda and its anti-Semitic mode, where the Jewish person is simultaneously, they are intellectualized, right? They are not, you know, true workers. They are, you know, they don't actually do any real action. They are fully, you know, in these, they're thinkers, you know, and Nazi propaganda would point out stuff like, you know, massive commentaries on scriptures, right? Like a Talmud or something like that, as evidence of their unwillingness to commit to an action, but rather hem and haw over everything. Which is, of course, you know, then contrasted to the fascist mode of just like, we'll just go do something. And usually that's, you know, go crack some skulls for no fucking reason. But, you know, that's something that kind of, I noticed that too. I didn't quite have the vocabulary to really, I don't know, to really put it together like you just did there. But yeah, you're absolutely right. But that kind of like, well, and that's the romanticism that went into the fascist movement as well. Like you can't get away from that.
Well, yeah. And that's what Arndt really articulates. Faust's translation, it moves from the Lutheran Reformation to the Romantics. To a full expression of romantic.
Speaking of anti-Semitism, the Lutheran Reformation. Anyway, this is not the time for me to bang on my drum about Martin Luther. Anyway.
All right. So in essence, the divine for Faust is the act. And he's interrupted by Mephistopheles. And this is when Faust, I guess he does his magic. And this is kind of a fun scene to try to imagine. Mephistopheles blows up big like a hippopotamus, then dissolves in a shade, or I guess the poodle blows up huge, and then dissolves into a kind of nothingness, and out pops Mephistopheles dressed like a courtier.
Bizarre kind of scene of like the dog like running around and around and around, or like spiraling around, and then it was a trip. I was really like, when I was reading it, I was like, oh, okay, so this is what I'm in for. Got it. A magic poodle just blew up and spun around, and now it's a weird evil guy. Cool. I really was sold on Faust at that point.
Yeah, it's weird. Okay, so the Mephistopheles, when he appears, he has this great little speech. Faust is asking him, who are you? What are you? He says, a part of that force which always willing always produces, always willing evil always produces good. That comes back to that Miltonic dictum that, you know, evil as this kind of driving force, is always going to be trying to subvert the will of God, but because the will of God is, you know, so awesome, then it's gonna inadvertently do good.
Right. It will fulfill the will of God even as it tries to subvert it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost as if Goethe had read Milton and then creatively misreads the purpose of Satan in Milton, and then a whole ton of English romantics who were familiar with Goethe persist in that reading of Satan in Milton's Paradise Lost and turn it into a trope for something else. Huh. Who'd have thunk it? Anyway. Faust says, this is a riddle, what does it mean? And Mephistopheles says, I am the spirit of eternal negation, and rightly so, since all that gains existence is only fit to be destroyed. That's why it would be best if nothing ever got created. Accordingly, my essence is what you call sin, destruction, or, to speak plainly, evil. you know, I was thinking about this. Okay, I like to read that just because it seems so hammy, right, right. And it's like fun to ham it up. But the other thing is, it really does clarify what Goethe is doing here. Sin and evil are not necessarily these kinds of acts as Dante would be thinking about them, or as Milton would be thinking about them. Sin and evil is negation. Right. It's stopping. It's constant criticizing. It's that cynical drag.
Yeah, like it's not a fully countering force in and of itself, as might be conceived of in a kind of like a dualist sense, like you have with well, like Manichaeism or Zoroastrianism, to an extent, where, you know, there's the force of good and the force of evil, but rather the, well, I don't know. It's the conception of like the evil is merely the absence of good. Like it's not a thing in and of itself. It's like how cold is the absence of heat. It's not a force in and of itself.
Yeah, exactly. It's negation.
Right.
It's nothingness. It's nihilism. Yeah. We're back to that kind of Nietzschean thing again. It has no clear definition because there's nothing there to define. So it just serves as a drag on everything else. It has no sense of self. So all it can do is tear down everything that it sees as having a sense of self. But it can also serve as a prod. So Faust says, you call yourself a part, yet stand before me whole. Mephistopheles says, I only speak the sober truth. You mortals, microcosmic fools, may like to think of yourselves as complete, but I'm a part of the part that was first, that first was all, part of the darkness that gave birth to light, proud light that now contests the senior rank of Mother Night, disputes her rights to space, yet it does not succeed, however much it strives, because it can't escape material fetters. Light emanates from matter, lends it beauty, but matter checks the course of light, and so I hope it won't be long before they both have been annihilated. He wants to drag everything back into the nothing.
Yeah.
This kind of and the way he's thinking about it, a long, long time ago on the blog, I posted a few links to this extraordinary extraordinarily rancid and bawdy poet from the 18th century, or 17th century, I guess, long 18th century, John Wilmot, the Earl of Rochester. Mm-hmm. And Rochester was, I mean, he was a nihilist, through and through, and a pretty rank person, but he becomes the model for, the reformed rake, because apparently he did have, a 2-year period of, I guess, recompense for his wild behavior while he was in bed, slowly dying of tertiary syphilis.
But as one does.
As one does. But anyway, and if you want to see the variation in permutation, that's where Jane Eyre, or the sort of romantic hero villain of Jane Eyre comes from, Mr. Rochester. Yeah. That's based on Lord Rochester, or at least the name is taken from Lord Rochester, any kind of evil, scheming, cynical aristocrat who only wants sex, sex, right. sex, and sometimes booze. But anyway, so that Rochester had written this poem called A Satire Upon Reason and Mankind. He wrote that, but he also wrote this great poem called Upon Nothing, which is an encomium on nothing. Right. Like what wonderfulness nothingness is. And he also expresses this desire to collapse back into the nothing. It's that bestial part of humanity that wants to lose its consciousness so that it ultimately doesn't have the burden of consciousness and can be nothing. The only thing it can do is tear at anything that it sees that has substance. In Shakespeare, this is horrifying. It's Iago.
Yeah.
The great cynical jester who's a pyromaniac. In Faustus, Mephistopheles, I don't know. He's nowhere near as evil as Iago. And if anyone's doing bad stuff, it's Faust, but God says that's okay because, you know, society. Right. And
yeah, honestly, Mephistopheles is rather like you can't help but have an affection for the character. I mean, I think there's a reason why he is one of the best known just through cultural osmosis devil figures. In the culture, because he's your sidekick making snide comments that amuse you throughout the whole, you know, throughout your period of self-destruction.
Well, okay, this is weird, but it reminds me of, all right, so the prank that, or the trick that Milton pulled is making Satan the most human character. Right. He's the most identifiable. He's the most human because he represents that fallenness of humanity. Okay. Faust is kind of a symbolic act. I don't find Faust to be a fascinating character at all. His nighttime speeches are okay. I mean, I can see how it's serving a kind of symbolic function, but I don't think there's enough to really hang together. Yeah. And I don't really find his quest or drive to be that fascinating, well, or at least as he expresses
yeah,
it.
Yeah, well, he's a cipher, basically. I think Faust exists for us to project upon more than anything else. And that's part of what makes, of course, Mephistopheles so essential, is because he's the person who's allowed to be a character in all of this. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing. I mean, the other part of this, I guess we'll have to get to this in the second episode we do on Faust Part 1. But the other part of this is I don't think Gretchen is that compelling as a character.
No.
I mean, she's really... She serves her symbolic function, and, you know, God bless her, she's as horny as Faust is, but that's about it. She serves the symbolic function, and that's all. Mephistopheles is the character who's closest to being human.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. Am I falling into a Mephistophelian trap by identifying with him? Yeah, perhaps. But it's still hard not to, because he's the most vibrant character here.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, I would put this out to the listeners, you know, put it up on Twitter. Who do you think should play Mephistopheles? I mean, I was running through my brain. There's a side of me that kind of wants to do, if you could have like Ghostbusters era Bill Murray again, like that level of just nihilistic cynicism. That might be kind of fun, but there's also something like
I think Michael Shannon could do interesting stuff with it.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder what Michael Shannon would do if he could pretend for 5 seconds he was Johnny Depp. Like, that's kind of like, I mean, there's this kind of theatricality.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That,
you know, it's really, really vibrant. There's something about Michael Shannon, which is threatening even when he's telling you.
That's a good point. I would like to say, like, listeners, if this is your first episode, we don't typically do fantasy casting for characters in this stuff.
But
the theatricality of Mephistopheles as a character, it almost demands it.
Yeah. So anyway, Faust is having this back and forth with Mephistopheles, and Mephistopheles is setting him up. Mephistopheles says, "Can I go now? This has been nice, and I'll come back and play, but I really have things I gotta do." And Faust says, "Well, you know, the chimney's right there. Go out the window." Mephistopheles says, "I can't go out the door because you've got a pentagram there." And he says, "Well, there's a chimney, there's a window, you know, help yourself." And Mephistopheles says, "Well, you know what? Devils have to go out the same way they came in. I'm sorry, man. It's the rules." So he's trying to articulate or trying to lull Faust into believing that there are rules to damnation. Right. And Faust is like, "Oh, okay, I get this. So you're setting me up so that if we work out a contract later, then it's all cool. But no, dude, I really want to see what you can do." And so Mephistopheles says, "You want to see what I can do, huh?" And so he conjures spirits to basically sing Faust to sleep. Yeah. But it's really kind of fun. I mean, it seems like this is another one of those hologram images to project on the wall. But what are they conjuring? The voice of the spirits comes in and says, "Vanish, dark arches, high but confining. Let azure blueness, brighter, more friendly, show from on high. Would that the dark clouds quickly departed." So they make it seem as if Faust's study has, like, the roof has come off and now he's staring at this beautiful sky. "Little stars twinkle, planets among them gleam in the sky, beauty ethereal, youth truly heavenly, gracefully bending, floats lightly past. Fond yearnings follow them on their paths, fluttering bits of garments abandoned brighten the landscape, brighten the bower where lost in illusion, lover unites with lover forever." They seem to be describing shooting stars, but mixing it with this weird kind of eroticism. Mm-hmm. And that becomes this kind of like running theme through what they're doing. So they're lulling him into this weird erotic trance.
Well, he
falls asleep.
And it's an erotic trance with the object being the natural world. And that's going to come around a lot too.
Oh, listener, prepare for the second section.
You'll never be more horny for landscape than when you're reading Faust.
Oh, Lord. Anyway, Mephistopheles basically lulls him to sleep. And this is another weird aside. This is the eroticism of landscape, but it's also playing in that weird trope of nature being, I guess, for lack of a better word, fuckable. This is something that Mary Shelley really picks up on. This is this kind of romantic trope of this eroticization of nature. In Frankenstein, it's a running theme that Frankenstein basically wants to sexually violate nature. That is how he tends to talk about his scientific quest. So, you know, if we're talking about these points of contact and Mary Shelley, I don't know if she had any German, but her husband, Percy Shelley, had tons of German and definitely read to her translations that he was doing of Faustus. I think she may have taken some of this material and turned it to her own feminist purposes or sort of proto-feminist purposes. And really kind of tweaked it in some fascinating ways. But anyway, so Mephistopheles takes the opportunity to duck out. He has some rats come in and gnaw through the pentagram so he can make it back to the door again. And then we have Faust's study. Okay, so this is something that was confusing to me the first time I read it. We have a scene that ends in Faust's study and then a scene that begins in Faust's study. And there are no markers, but apparently a few days have passed.
Right, yeah. And that was – it took me a moment because, you know, this was my first time reading it. It sort of took me a moment. And this happens several times in the text where you're left to infer from well into whatever section you're reading that, oh, some time has passed or like what have you. And yeah, this is one of those that was – it was like, oh, so I get – he – is this just when he wakes up? Like what is going on? But yeah.
Yeah, it's so he has this lament, you know, Faust ends, you know, he has this lament, ah, I've been duped once more. But then a few days later, apparently, Mephistopheles knocks on the door and has to be invited in three times, much like Beetlejuice. And Faust lets him in and he starts bemoaning his life again. What am I living for? I'm too old to live for pleasure only, too young to be without desire. What can I hope for from this world? You must abstain, refrain, renounce. That is the everlasting song in every ear, one that our whole life long we hear each hour hoarsely singing. When morning comes, I always wake in terror and feel like shedding bitter tears because the day I see will not fulfill a single wish of mine before it's over, will dampen any faintest hope of pleasure by its capricious strictures. And with a thousand petty matters will stifle the creative urge that stirs my heart. The God that dwells within my breast can deeply stir my inmost being. The one that governs all my faculties cannot realize its purposes. And so for me, existence is a burden, death to be welcomed, and this life detested. He's got this frustration. It's sort of like middle-aged angst. He understands that there's more, but he only understands that there's more because he can't have it.
Yeah. Right?
So he has this rumination. It's a real articulation of nihilism. He says, cursed be to start the high opinion that the mind has of itself. Cursed be what as appearance intrudes on and deludes our senses, and cursed be the falseness of our dreams, their empty promise of a lasting name. Cursed be what flatters us as things we own, as wife and child, as fields our workmen plow. Cursed be Mammon too, both when he with his treasures incites us to bold enterprise, and when to provide us idle pleasure he cushions us a bed of ease. A curse upon a curse upon the nectar of the vine, a curse upon love's highest favors, a curse on hope, a curse on faith, but cursed be patience most of all. Okay. It's the possibility of turning away from everything and lapsing into nothingness, which makes him ripe for Mephisto's wiles. Now, the question would be, why did the suicidal drive not do that either?
I guess
because in a way that's active, I'm not sure. And that might, I'm guessing that's one of those things that Goethe just, well, back when I was in my 20s, I felt like this.
Now that I'm in my 40s, right, right. Like now that I've been tinkering with this poem play for, you know, 30, 40 years, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, so it seems to me something that's not exactly workoutable, though I suppose one could say that the suicidal drive, the desire, the way he articulates it is a desire to see the next frontier, because this is all over, is still something that puts him in the camp of the good because it's a striving nonetheless.
Right, right. He's still moving. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's striving. And therefore, it's beating back the, what is the term? Ataraxia? Am I pulling that out of nowhere? That might be a. There's some sort of Greek term for spiritual sloth that is theologically used, and I cannot think of it now. I think I might. But I think that might have just been a disease from the Elder Scrolls video game series that I just said there. But
but that's, I mean, the theological sloth, yeah, that's pretty, yeah, much it. Okay, so that's when Mephistopheles says, okay, then here we go. Let's do it. I'll bind myself to serve you here, be at your beck and call without respite. And if or when we meet again beyond, then you will do the same for me. Faust says, with the beyond, I cannot be much bothered. Once you annihilate this world, the other can have its turn at existing. The earth's the source of all my joys, and the sun shines upon my sorrows. If ever I can be divorced from them, it cannot matter what then happens. I do not want to hear still more discussion of whether there will be future loves and hates, and whether also in those spheres there's an above or a below. The transcendent of the world is what drives him. And it's kind of material transcendence, I guess. That's what drives him. The joy he takes in being, I suppose, is kind of fundamental to him. So he says it doesn't really matter what happens in the afterlife. Okay, so this is one of those moments that's quintessential to the text. Unpacking what Faust's wager is, because Faust doesn't sell his soul. He proposes something
else. Yeah, it's right? It's, yeah, that was what's, that jumped out at me too, that the, you know, the story that you absorbed, like me, you know, a layman through osmosis, is that, like, oh, Faust is the guy who sold his soul for knowledge and then hubris, blah 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 blah. But yeah, he's basically making the he's basically making, like, you know, the on Seinfeld, when Jerry and George come up with a pilot for a sitcom and their pitch is that a guy gets sentenced to be someone's butler. That's yeah. Right. Faust is basically submitting himself to that sentence.
Okay. So this is where I wish I knew the German so I could unpack it. But I'm going to walk through what he actually says, go to Arndt's notes, and then see if I can figure this out. All right. You'd think I would have done this ahead of time. Anyway, Faust says, if on a bed of sloth I ever lie contented, may I be done for then and there. If ever you, with lies and flattery, can lull me into self-complacency or dupe me with a life of pleasure, may that day be the last for me. This is my wager. Here's my hand and mind. If I should ever say to any moment, tarry, remain, you are so fair, then you may lay your fetters on me. Then I will gladly be destroyed. Then they can toll the passing bell. Your obligations then be ended. The clock may stop. The hand may fall. And time at last for me be over. Consider well your words. Will not forget them. Nor should you. What I've said is not presumptuous blasphemy. If I stagnate, I am a slave. Why should I care if yours or someone else's? Okay. So here's how Arndt tries to unpack that. He says, the concept of the moment, Augenblick, literally, blink or glance of the eye, is crucial for Faust as a whole, nor does Goethe subsequently allow the reader to forget the terms of the wager that Faust here proposes and that Mephistopheles accepts. He gives us some information about part two. Then he comes back and says, what Faust has in mind is the condition for his wager is not only a sense of satisfaction, which would complete and negate his striving, but also an absolute fulfillment of all desire, where the temporal and experiential process involved in such striving would be gathered together within such a single moment so that time itself would be transcended. Yeah. Okay. What Faust seems to be getting at is that he wants that transcendent moment. Right. He wants time to stop. He wants to step beyond space and time and into the eternal.
He's after nirvana. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing is, Mephistopheles just set himself up. If that's what Faust wants, then Faust will be so beyond the terms of the bargain that the bargain will not exist anymore. Yeah. So it's this way in which Mephistopheles thinks he's doing one thing, but he sets himself up for a game that he can't lose because Mephistopheles doesn't understand the terms that Faust is putting out there, because Faust, as mere human mortal, cannot articulate those terms. So that's, I mean, that to me is the kind of joke of this, is that what Faust wants is to step beyond space and time. And once he has stepped beyond space and time, then he will be satisfied with experience, the experience that is non-experience of all experience and so on and so forth. And we can get lost in ourselves in these kind of mystical translations. And Mephistopheles just thinks, oh, well, when he's had enough.
Right, right. He'll get bored or tired, and then it's all over. Yeah.
Exactly. Mephistopheles cynically thinks that what he means is, I guess, material exhaustion. Right. And what Faust means is something else.
He means the negation of anticipation and nostalgia all at once. Yeah.
Exactly. So, Mephistopheles says, okay, let's do it.
Put her there.
And where does he take him? A bar.
I mean, where else do you start? I mean, come on.
Oh, okay. It's I guess we'll end at Auerbach's Tavern because I have nothing to say about Auerbach's Tavern. The very first place they go is into, it's sort of like, all right, this is what's so fascinating and fun and weird about this work is like, okay, everything we've been talking about up till now has had to do with these sort of mystical formulations, these formulations of romantic transcendentalism, or I guess proto-romantic transcendentalism, this striving which seeks to connect the material and the transcendent, which Goethe, following Schiller, seems to see in certain kinds of sexual activity. There's all this symbolic stuff, and there's all this, you know, really, really heady material that we've just wasted about 2 hours going through. And as soon as they're into it, basically, Mephistopheles takes him to a frat party.
It's it jumps immediately into what's that line from Iggy Pop's Lust for Life? Beat my brain with liquor and drugs. Like, go straight there.
All right. So Auerbach's Tavern is an actual place, as we were talking about in the prelude episode. And all this scene is here to do is just be slapstick. Yeah. They pull a bunch of pranks on a bunch of students. Faust is kind of bored while Mephistopheles is pulling, he's making wine from nothing and making fire from wine. And a student rides a wine cask, and everyone gets uproariously drunk, and Faust is bored.
what a great way to round out part one of our exciting series.
Yeah, and so then they go to the witch's kitchen, which is I want to extend the discussion just to the witch's kitchen because it introduces the next part. Yeah. The witch's kitchen again is this weird, strange hodgepodge. This was something that Goethe began, or he had sketched out initially as part of the original, you know, extraordinarily Germanic design. Mm-hmm. And then changed it later on when, or didn't exactly change it, but just grew bored with it, when he went to Italy and was like, classicism. Right. the other thing was the Walpurgisnacht. The Walpurgisnacht was supposed to be a giant orgy, which ended with a bunch of witches kissing a goat's ass. But he decided to classicize it and turn it into something else. I feel like we're really missing out. But anyway, the Witch's Kitchen, it was something that he felt he had to have in there as a bridge to the main, or what he was thinking of as the main plot, the Gretchen plot. And the Witch's Kitchen is another weird sort of hodgepodge where you have talking animals, you have this kind of Prince of Misrule with Mephistopheles, you have the topsy-turviness, you have the bloody witch. And again, Faust is bored with this. But in the mirror, he sees the... Okay, the reason they go to the witch's kitchen is basically to get him some...
Right, right, exactly. He needs... he's going to need his youthful vigor for this bender of all benders coming up. Yeah.
I'm not just being crude about this. That's what they say in the text. This guy, he's an old man. He needs to be able to get it up again. Do you have a potion? And the witch says, yeah, let me do some stuff. And she performs another kind of mock Eucharist. Yeah. But what happens here is that Faust sees a magic mirror and sees the image of ideal beauty in the mirror. So the idea is that he doesn't even actually need the potion. He can get aroused again from this kind of like idealized eroticism, which transcends just the horny lust.
Right, right. This is Platonic lust, we might call it.
Yeah, you know what? That sounds good to me. Platonic lust. That's what Faust finds. Guys, in the next section we do in this, we're going to come to Faust's wank cave. So just bear with us.
Yes.
But anyway, this is the first intimation that what we're about to get into is the Gretchen plot. And I guess that's where we'll leave off tonight. This has been so weird.
It's weird already. We're not even really getting to we haven't even gotten to the plot yet, really. Which is just all that indication of just what a strange work Faust is, and something I'm going to be thinking about a lot in between our recording now and when we record sort of the next section or the next, you know, when we round out part one by talking about the Gretchen plot. I'm going to be thinking long and hard and maybe doing some reading even. No guarantees. I'm very lazy on what makes this a canonical work, right? Like what, and we've talked about this before. It's actually been a few episodes since we talked about the nature of canon and things like that. And we might even do a special episode about that, like circling back around and talking about what we've learned about canon and canonicity. But the notion that we, especially when we're talking about Don Quixote, right? That canon isn't, that these works are representative of the milieu of their time. It's that they break out of the milieu of their time. And that is definitely going to be, I guess, I want to do a lot of pondering about Faust in that respect.
maybe we might think about Faust and the tropes of pornography.
Yeah.
And I guess we'll leave it with that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. But again, a fine way to round it out. And God, Claude, as ever, I am deeply in your debt for actually knowing what you're talking about. Because it really...
Well,
even providing just like a... Because I guess listeners at home, you have to understand that I usually come into a recording session with a lot of inchoate ideas scrambling around in my brain because that's just generally how I exist. That's how my brain works most of the time. I do take notes and I work from notes when we're talking here and everything. But, you know, Claude is, of course, the backbone of the whole operation. And this is just, Claude, a shout out to how much you're helping me understand my own thoughts about Faust by being that backbone. And so then I can finally like sort of gather what has been swirling around in my brain, which I imagine is only going to get worse once we get to the actual esoteric alchemical part later on.
Oh, but, God.
this is my way of saying everyone, listeners out there in Radio Land, Claude is an absolute mensch.
Well, I do my best, but anyway, you know, this is a work where the orgy in the Hartz Mountains is not even the most pervy thing that happens. So if you want to hear about the pervy things that happen, I guess
tune in next time.
So we'll pick back up with the rest of Faust Part 1 in the next episode. We'll pretty much cover the Gretchen plot and Faust, you misogynist fuck. But anyway, we'll pick up with the Gretchen plot and the complications of that, and then we'll try to unpack the ending. And then in case you haven't been following along, the plan for Faust Part 2 is to take it act by act. because if it took us this much to get through this much of part one, part two is
right. This is dense stuff we're about to get into.
Yeah, next year might be the Faust part two year. All right. So anyway, stay tuned and see you next time.